Our next speaker today is going to be Mike Burnt from the DNR, who I know has been a recipient of funding from the LCCMR to look at some of the effects of mining in northern Minnesota. And he's going to talk to us today on the source and fate of sulfate released by mining on Minnesota's Iron Range.
Well, we haven't got our funding yet, but we're hoping it goes through and we get it for the next couple of years. What I'm going to show today is what we've done in preparation, more or less, for to get the LCCMR funding and to rationalize it. Before I do that, though, I thought I'd mention that I'm a full circle person as well. I also worked for Ernie Lehman at one point when I was an undergraduate and went back to school as a result. So here's my outline. I'm going to talk a little bit about the environmental concern. I'm not really allowed to talk about policy either, and so I won't. I'm just going to try to stick to the science and talk about what we've seen so far with sulfate concentrations and loading in the St. Louis River Basin. And also, then I'll get into the geochemical processes that lie below it, beneath it. I'm a geochemist. Hydrology is important. I've been finding that out as well. You can't really understand the geochemistry of the sulfate without understanding the hydrology. And then I'll just wrap with some conclusions. Okay, the St. Louis River Basin is the St. Louis River Basin, most of you know where it is. This map shows you that it's host to two world-class ore deposits, occurrences, which is pretty interesting. At the base of the Duluth complex, there's the sulfide deposits that we saw Jim Miller and Ernie talk about. And then there's the famous iron formation, which has been mined for over 100 years. I'm not going to talk so much about the sulfide deposits because those aren't mined yet. I'm talking about the existing sulfate relationships, which we'll show are really strongly affected by what's in the Bawabic iron formation. But we're keeping that's the sulfide mining that's been proposed has a large effect on why we're doing the studies, because there might be more sulfate introduced into the watershed, and we just want to know how it's behaving, what's going on in there. We don't really have a good feeling. And right at this time, the environmental rules are sort of changing or in the process of being modified, and so it's kind of a complicated time for the proposers, and I'm sorry for that. Let's see. The pyrite in the Bawabic iron formation, we found that there is a significant occurrence of it in locations in some layers. It's been coming to light more recently with some the finding of some high sulfate in some pits. It's a little bit more common than we thought in some seams. And so we've been really looking more into it. Generally, there's three environmental issues that, or three or four that we think about. One is the sulfuric acid that everybody's familiar with. In the iron formation, it's not usually a problem because there's a lot of carbonates around, so it titrates it. And so, instead of getting the acid and the metal release associated with it, we get the solutions that are more titrated, so you get a sulfate bicarbonate water with some cations. This is what we usually see, what I'm used to seeing in most cases. We'll find out that it's a little bit different than this in the iron formation. Mercury was a big issue for a while, and it still continues to be. And the reason it's an issue with respect to sulfate is because the sulfate reduction process, sulfate-reducing bacteria tend to convert mercury into methylmercury, and then that's the mercury that accumulates in the fish and causes the limitations on the amount you can consume for the fish. Typically, we're finding that it's an important process, but it doesn't necessarily mean if you have high sulfate in a watershed that you're going to have more mercury. It's more of an opportunistic thing. That's what we seem to be finding out, that you really need just this whole combination of things. The sulfate getting into the water doesn't mean you're going to have high mercury in the fish. And then there's this is getting to be a big one, the wild rice sulfate standard is being evaluated on a case-by-case basis. There's some thoughts or indications in the older literature, at least, that that if you have sulfate reduction taking place within the watershed, it limits the wild rice growth potential. And right now, there's a 10 ppm standard, which is very low for sulfate. 10 ppm standard that's being considered in a lot of locations, but it's really on a case-by-case basis. We have very little to do with it. It's PCA's call. So those are the reasons we're studying sulfate in this region. Okay, so what did we do? We did more or less a fairly significant reconnaissance study. And what we wanted to use was what I'll refer to as a snapshot approach, where we just went out and did a lot of sampling at different seasonal situations, like May runoff or after a big storm or a big wet period in the region, or maybe when it's been really dry for a long time. We just want to get an idea of what does the sulfate picture look like in the St. Louis River watershed. So what we did is we just monitored all down the stream, and then we measured the major tributaries coming into the stream to get their pour points, where they were coming off. In the St. Louis River watershed, you know, there's all these mines up here, many active, many not active. So there's pits that are overflowing. There's some pumping that's active that's going on. And so that we found is probably one of the major controllers of the sulfate in the river. And so this is kind of a busy slide. There's a lot of things on it. This is way downstream near Cloquet, for those of you familiar with it. And this is way upstream, the headwaters. And so these connected lines here represent the actual concentrations in the river during different seasons within a two-day period, a snapshot of what the river profile looks like, as close as we can get to it anyway. And then the color represents sort of dryness, how dry the season was. So a really blue color means pretty wet, and this red is just really dry, and then, you know, it varied periodically. The dots that aren't connected are the triangles are watersheds that have mines in them, and they're just the tributary that's coming into the river. And these other circles are tributaries that don't have mines in them. So obviously you can see that the mining area, the river goes through it. These tributaries from the mining areas come in and increase the sulfate. Then when you get past the mining region, these tributaries redilute it. So you get a kind of a peak in the river, and then it decreases eventually. Concentrations are up to, so far for the main river, you know, about 100 ppm, and the largest we've seen so far is about 180 ppm. When we've talked about these sorts of things with people out west, they think that's nothing. Those are really low. But it's significant in terms of that 10 ppm standard. Okay. This is sort of another look at the same data, actually a little bit more extended, where we show kind of the hydrology on it. And you can see that the flow varied quite considerably up, you know, between, you know, almost shut off to over 10,000 foot cubed per second. This is at the Scanlon Dam, which receives all the water that we're looking at. And then what I've got here is the green is the mining rivers, just an average, just statistical treatment of it. The red is the sulfate in the St. Louis River, and the non-mining tributaries are down here that dilute the stream, that dilute the sulfate. So it's pretty straightforward what's going on there. But then what we're really interested in, and here's another thing. That doesn't really give you anything on loading, that last diagram. But it's pretty well distributed throughout the watershed. No, there's not one big river. I don't know why there's such a big other thing. I think that just has to do with the air and trying to get a snapshot when you have maybe more rain in one area and not in another, and you try to put it all together. But when we looked at the entire river budget at the time when we did this over a period of days, we had this other section. I just put it other. I don't really know what that means. But there was 126 tons per day total on that day, or on that period of time, coming through the river. But if we look at loading over the Scanlon Dam, and here I just look at the sulfate concentration from a stream sample, and compare it. So this is a discharge at the Scanlon Dam versus the sulfate loading calculated by that discharge times the concentration of sulfate. We see that the amount isn't always that high. This was that 126 that we determined. But sometimes it's only 25, and up to other times it's up to 200 and over 200 tons per day coming over the Scanlon Dam. So it's a lot of sulfate. So now we're going to try to figure out what exactly, what's controlling the sort of seasonal changes and things like that in a little more detail. Find out, if you've driven around in there, in that area, there's a lot of wetlands, and how are these impacting the sulfate? Is sulfate really being reduced very much, or is it being reduced a lot? And so I've got this schematic diagram, just kind of discussing some of the concerns that or the thoughts we have. There's potentially pits and lakes where you can have sulfate reduction within the sediments or in the deeper waters if they're reducing. You have the wetlands where there can be sulfate reduction as well. There's groundwater flow that gets into the streams. There's the sulfide oxidation, which can be periodic and then rinse. You generally tend to get a the pyrite oxidizes during the all year long, and then it kind of rinses off in the storms. And let's just see what's going on as best we can. The pyrite oxidation process I talked about before, this is what I'm kind of, there was a person who asked the question about uncertainty in the past. I worked with him in the distant future too, or this distant past too. And we found a lot of sulfate in western Minnesota till groundwaters. And typically what we saw was the reaction that I had put up there before, whereas you had an increase in sulfate, you tended to see an increase in calcium, and not so much so in magnesium. And that wasn't really that unexpected. The tills that were being weathered and producing the arsenic that we were studying at the time had a lot of pyrite in them. When we started looking at this water in the St. Louis River, we were seeing something more like the magnesium in the blue seemed to be increasing more than the calcium. The calcium wasn't really increasing that much. So this was a little bit of a puzzle until we looked at, we got a mine report in this case. I'm going to also mention, we don't collect all this data. Sometimes the data gets brought to us by the mining companies who are applying for permits. And so some of the data, and I didn't really distinguish it, comes from those reports, and some of it comes from us. The data I showed before was pretty much all from our own labs. In this particular case, we got a report up from a mine that wants to be the Mesabi Nugget property, and they had a pretty high sulfate pit, and we found that it was actually a magnesium sulfate pit instead of a calcium sulfate. Calcium was always staying low. And when we went through and kind of analyzed it, or I should say they did, and we with our help, the overall reactions in the iron formation seemed to be this acid titration by a magnesium siderite mineral. And what's interesting is that when you have, there's a kinetic aspect to this. When you have, if you had something like dolomite, this is the way I modeled it first before we actually looked at the minerals that were undergoing the oxidation in that case. If you had attacked that, and as a geochemist, you can do things like suppress minerals and things like that from forming. We had to suppress any magnesium carbonate mineral, and then we could, then if you titrated the carbonate mineral, you start precipitating calcite. We went out in the outcrops, we found calcite all over the outcrops, but the waters were magnesium rich, which was very, which was a puzzle for a little bit, until they started finding out, they started really looking at the rocks. And what happens is there's the overall reaction that looks something like this. You don't have to think about it too much, but the iron siderite doesn't really do any acid titration because it tends to end up in the iron hydroxides. You end up with a magnesium sulfate bicarbonate water, though. We haven't seen any evidence of acid, even when you have the very high salinities, that the siderite seems to be abundant enough, and there's enough magnesium and calcium to keep the waters from going acid, even when there's 1 or 2% sulfite in the rocks. Okay, so what about this sulfate reduction taking place? It's hard to think there couldn't be a reduction if you see scenes like this. There's a lot of stuff going on. And how can we look at that? How can we get a handle on that? And for that, we started delving into sulfate isotopes. Sulfur has two isotopes, 32 and 34, that are very common. Oxygen has several, too, and the most common one measured is O18. O16 is usually what oxygen has, but there's a little bit of O18. And these molecules, each of these types of molecules, if they have sulfur 34 or O18, are heavier than the most common sulfate molecules. And it turns out bacteria distinguish between between which sulfate. When they reduce sulfate to sulfide, they tend to avoid the heavier isotopes. And so this causes the more sulfate reduction you get, the heavier the isotope molecule the molecules become. And so we thought, with the modern day situations with mass spectrometers and things, it's actually fairly cheap and easy to get a sulfur isotope analysis for both. Back in the day, I spent some time with mass spectrometers, and I decided not to become an isotope geochemist. But now I'm kind of going back that way because you can just purchase the analysis rather than spending your time in the lab. And I'm just going to look at sulfur. Now, this again, we've been once in a while when the mines approach us and they say they have this project, we start mentioning isotopes, and that's we don't really know if it's going to be useful or not. And I approach it that way. Some of them give us some data, some don't. We collected a lot of our own data. And so what I've got plotted here is just what we've seen so far, all the data I have on sulfur 34S. So what this thing here means is heavy sulfate is up here, light sulfate is here. This numbers up here, I won't really go into it if you're not familiar with it, but mean that it's got a little bit more of the sulfur 34. There's been there's something that's affected it. Another thing that happens when you oxidize sulfide in a waste rock or in whatever location, it tends to be 100% complete. There is no fractionation, really. What happens is the sulfate takes on the del-34S of what's being oxidized. And so it can also kind of act as a tracer. Where did that sulfate come from? Did it come from that sulfide or that sulfide? If the sulfides have different del-34S values, so you can use it as a tracer, as long as no sulfate reduction took place. This was our reconnaissance measurements along the St. Louis River. We've got that same kind of thing. This is upstream. This is downstream. And that's surprising. That's actually a pretty big variation that we saw in a dry season compared to a wet season. Typically, you would think that there'd be more reduction taking place during a wet season than a dry season because things are being buried. But we saw the opposite as far as if that's the cause of this. An alternative cause could be you're tapping a different source during the different seasons. Then I look at all the watershed values we have, and there is clear indication that there is sulfate reduction taking place somewhere in the watersheds at different times during the seasons. How can we get a hold on when that's taking place, how that's affecting the water? Let's see, what else did I want to say? This value, 41, that's pretty high, Del 34S. And I was surprised that one of the mining companies presented us with that value. Just to give some idea on the amount of sulfate reduction you have in order to account for a value of Del 34S of 41, which was what that highest one was, you have to have something like 70% sulfate reduction in that particular setting. Let's see, and then this is kind of a complicated complicated slide. What happens is, and I'll just kind of go through it a little bit because I have a little bit of time. If you start with 0% sulfate reduced, when you think you have a starting water solution, or starting water with maybe around, I think I assumed a value of 8 for the sulfate that's in the water, the initial sulfide that would precipitate would be highly negative. But as that water moves down the stream or something, or along the geochemical sequence, its isotopic value increases, and increases a little more. As more sulfide is precipitated. And each time it precipitates iron sulfide, there's there's an offset that occurs, and in this case, I assumed it was constant, 30 per mil. And the bulk iron sulfide eventually will look like the starting sulfate. But what we're looking at when we're looking at the stream samples is just this upper line here. And so if we started at a value of 10 and we found a stream that came through the wetland at a value of plus 41, then it's around 70% of that sulfate had to have been removed by precipitation within the wetland. And if we go back, we see this 5 per mil offset, around, or maybe 5 to even a little more, then that suggests if sulfate reduction caused it, if we go back to this slide, maybe 15%, 20% of the sulfate that was being removed is being reduced within the wetlands during the dry season. But it's a little more complicated than that even. When we look at the whole watershed and we put in oxygen isotopes too, we see that there's all sorts of variation, always up to on this side. And then there's, you'll notice that the 41 value isn't here anymore because they didn't do oxygen on that one. But the stream chemistry in the St. Louis River changed, and there's all sorts of things in the watershed that can kind of explain it. But we just kind of want to get a little bit better handle on that. And I'm just going to give you kind of what I've been thinking causes that whole variation. And I'm just going to compare a dry condition situation to a wet condition situation in the watershed. And when the conditions are dry, I think there's oxidation that's going on within the piles, but there's also oxidation that's going on the very top of the wetlands. There are iron sulfides that were formed during the wet periods, but they're being oxidized during the dry period. But they're not getting into the water. They're just sitting there, and they're being stored. Oxidized sulfates being stored, just like it is in the waste rock piles. Then, under wet conditions, you rinse off that sulfate, plus you're rinsing off all the sulfate from these situations. So you get a very high load during the wet seasons of a different sulfate, of sulfate with a different signature than the sulfate you had when it was very dry. When it's very dry, this component is probably more important. Let's go back. This component becomes more important. You're seeing that residual sulfate signal a little bit better from the sulfate reduction because there's not as much of this other water coming through. Now, when you get to more streamful conditions, you get a lot more of this water coming through that's got this rinsed sulfate in it, and this becomes less important. So at this very busy slide, I hope I can explain it, but we've seen that these are the types of sulfate you get very close to the outcrop or within the pit right next to the outcrop. And so what's happening is it's the process, that sulfide oxidation process is a little bit different from the sulfate oxidation process that occurs within the wetland itself. One takes on the Del 18O of the water. This is pretty much the meteoric water, Del 18O. So the sulfate's assembled somehow from the meteoric water and the sulfur molecule, whereas the other takes on a more atmospheric value. So when the oxidation takes place in the wetland, you get something that's more up in this way. So the St. Louis River, for example, starts out very wetland rich, and then during the mining, when it goes through the mining district, it drops in this direction, and then it comes back up in this way. And it does that both during the wet and dry seasons. But there's a shift towards the more rinsed sulfate from the wetlands during the summer or during the wet period. So my conclusions then is the sulfate concentrations are elevated during the dry seasons, but the sulfate loading is the highest during the wet seasons. And this magnesium siderite thing, it appears that looking at the magnesium to calcium ratio in the iron formation, it's somewhat of a marker of where that sulfide actually came from, because whenever that sulfide's there, it seems like the magnesium siderite's close by, and so you can kind of see this water more clearly through other processes that typically increase the calcium in the water with the sulfate. And the other one is the sulfate isotopic data indicate that the wetlands are heavily influencing the sulfate output into the St. Louis River. That's what I have so far, but we're gonna be doing a lot more detailed work. Each one of those sulfate isotope points can tell a story for each watershed, and we haven't really interpreted it to that level yet. I'm working with Jim Miller, who gave the first talk today, and a student, and we're going to be analyzing the source rock and try to understand the isotopic distribution within there. And we're doing a lot more stream sampling nearby. And hopefully we have even a clearer picture than we could give so far. So thank you. Yeah, that's probably true. It's not always true. We're actually doing a study to look at that. And it may not matter for mercury, it turns out. In fact, we're weighing several things because if the wetlands are actually removing a lot of the sulfate, then maybe that's a good thing. Then you have less sulfate downstream in a location where maybe it maybe is more problematic. You know, right now I can't really give you great details on that, but we have seen instances where there's a lot of sulfate reduction going on, but no extra methyl mercury forming. And in that case, well, it's a sulfate removal system.